ask yourself, do you want to be fish? Come on.
Check out this bizarre rapper style used by me, the B.I.G. I put my...
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Cindy's Birthday Party, the hip-hop podcast that explores hip-hop culture and rap music from a historical and philosophical perspective. My name is Danny. I'm here with my co-host, Big E.
What's happening, y'all?
And this is segment number two, or part two, of our discussion of hip-hop beef. And we left off in part one discussing LL Cool J and versus Cool Moe Dee. And I think it's maybe, I'm just off of the top of my head, the last big battle slash beef that probably for the decade of the 80s, would you say? I can't think of another one right off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Of course, now that I've said that, somebody will be on social media and be like, you forgot about so-and-so, you know. But that's just off the top, that's the one I'm thinking
about. And actually, that's the kind of stuff we want. If you know of one,
no doubt.
Let us know.
Yep. Because there are a lot of them that are, you know, another one I thought of from the 80s, it's not really a full-blown beef necessarily, but Dougie Fresh versus the Fat Boys.
Yeah, okay.
About the whole beatbox thing.
Right. Yeah, that was, kind of a minor beef.
But yeah, it's kind of like Doug saying, you know, I'm the original human beatbox, you know. And
Buffy,
Yeah, he would take shots at him from time to time, but it was never like really like a full-blown back-and-forth thing.
Yeah.
But Cool Moe Dee versus LL Cool J.
Yes.
So Cool Moe Dee, old-school MC, one of the greats from the first era of rap music, who's one of the few guys who was able to make a transition from the first era to the golden age.
Yes.
And LL Cool J at this time is just, you know, he's had an album called Bigger and Deffer, which is double platinum.
Yeah.
He's a legitimate superstar, right? Mm-hmm. And Cool Moe Dee has a song comes out called How You Like Me Now, which I think is produced by Teddy Riley. This is a crazy thing. Like, Teddy Riley's like 16, okay? And he's producing songs for hit songs.
Right.
You know, again, this is, I like to point out the age of people sometimes because people need to understand how young a lot of these cats are when they're doing a lot of these phenomenal things that we look back on now and marvel at.
Yes.
But in the song How You Like Me Now, he says, I'm bigger and better, forget about Deffa.
Yeah.
Every time I rock the mic, I left her. Stay in your brain. But that is a clear shot at LL. Yep. And then on the cover of How You Like Me Now, the Jeep is rolling over the red Kangol, which is synonymous with
LL. And so there you have it.
And the crazy thing about it is, even without that line, and the third verse has some stuff that people say are directed towards LL, but it's not as overt.
Mm-hmm.
But even without that, you know, How You Like Me Now is still a great song.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what kind of makes it as powerful as it does too.
Yeah, and me being not that big of a Cool Moe Dee fan at the time, I still understand his place in hip hop, you know, as being, you know, him being one of the greats to ever do it, quite honestly. So I can't do nothing but respect him on that. Not the biggest fan of his necessarily, but hey, you know.
Right. So then your boy LL comes back, Jack the Ripper.
Yes.
Now, this is where the point of contention with me, okay, because everybody says, oh, LL came at Jack the Ripper and he murdered Cool Moe Dee. I want somebody to tell me, other than the fact that the beat was phenomenal, what did LL do that was so damaging to Cool Moe Dee with that song? Because to me, if you take Jack the Ripper, and then you take Moe Dee had a response song called Let's Go.
Okay.
Right? You remember the lyrics. Jack the Ripper, it's, there are things said about Cool Moe Dee in that song, but most of the stuff that's said is only if you know specifically that there is a battle going on between the two of them.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
It's not really stuff that's coming out. A lot of it is just another, you know, as you call it, the yelling LL. It's just, LL doing his thing, bringing the energy and everything like you know him does. And the beat is just
pulsating.
Beyond.
Yeah, just going. Yeah. So, yeah, I can You've possibly convinced me a bit now that I think back on it.
You know, everybody who listened to our first set of podcasts, you know, we put LL on our Mount Rushmore.
Right.
Right. So, but I just felt like lyrically, just based on the lyrics, I always thought that Kool Moe Dee was a better lyricist than LL Cool J.
Hmm.
Now, as we know, when you have a battle, as they did, that is based on records, it's not two dudes standing on stage going back and forth at each other, which, you know. So when it's based on who's putting out the best record, this record about the other guy, a lot of times the production, the beats and all of that become a part of it. And so you don't necessarily win or lose just based on your lyrical ability.
Yeah, there's no, like you said, there's no battle where two individuals are right in front of each other, you know, duking it out, so to speak.
Yes.
Someone puts out an album or a song. Up here comes a response to it later on. So yeah, it, and like you say, the beat, the production, and everything involved with the song can tend to sway your opinions on who actually won the day in that particular, you know, little fight right there. So
yeah, because I've always felt like the reason that most people say LL won, it's more of a popularity contest to me.
Right.
More so than the quality of what was being said, because I think if you listen to Kool Moe Dee's lyrics from Let's Go, and you listen to LL's lyrics from Jack the Ripper, I think that Moe Dee in a dissing sense, dissing another dude. I always felt like Moe Dee's stuff was more direct and a little deeper, especially when the DJ is just cutting up the letter L, and he's saying all these words that start with loser, lot of, and he's just going off, you know. So I just always felt that Moe Dee lyrically won that battle. But like I said, I know most people don't agree with me, but I always challenge people, hey, tell me what LL said that was so damaging to Moe Dee.
And that's a good point. And actually, yeah, I can agree with you on that now. And thinking back, yeah, a lot of it is, like you said, the popularity of the artist at the time. LL being who he was at the time was just this in-your-face, fiery, yelling guy marching back and forth across the stage.
Yes.
You know, a lot of demonstrative poses and, you know, bending and shouting. So, yeah, right. You might tend to think that, and yeah, he got that.
Putting his hand up like a shark's fin.
Yeah,
on his
head. Right. A lot of things going on.
A lot of energy.
A lot of energy, right.
You know, I always say, you know, like in baseball, they say, you got they have five tool guys.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like they got all these, they can do all these different things.
Right.
Like MCs are maybe not five tools, but like there are certain things, like if you take lyrics and flow and stage presence, energy, that type of thing, and you look at all of those categories, like LL fills out all of those.
Yeah, a good portion of them. Yeah.
Like some guys may be great MCs, but they don't necessarily have all of those things.
Exactly, yeah.
But LL was a dude, especially in the early days, man. You know, like Rakim says, MC means move the crowd. LL is on stage, he's going to move the crowd because it's just such energy coming
forward. Exactly, yeah.
So,
yeah.
But that was that battle between LL and Moe Dee. I don't know. What would you say the greatest significance of it, I think, to me, is it relaunches the career of Kool Moe Dee. You know, as a guy who was a first generation MC, and now he's, you know, 10 years later, he's in the golden era and he's relevant again.
Yeah.
Because he had other songs other than just How You Like Me. Now he had a lot of hit songs. Another one, I Go to Work.
Forget about that. Right.
Listen to that lyrically, folks. If you want to hear a lyrical technician, check him out on that.
Yeah.
For LL though, it's interesting. Historically, I think looking back in retrospect, it helped him because so many people view him as the guy who won. But I think at that particular moment, it kind of showed some vulnerability because a lot of people started going at LL then.
Yeah.
You know, I remember Ice-T had some lines for him, I think, on the Power album where he said some stuff about LL. And I'm not going to repeat on here because we got a PG-13 show.
Yeah.
You know, but various people would start to go at him. And then when his Walking with a Panther album comes out and it's not as successful and people saying he's falling off.
Right.
That kind of thing, you know. And I think that, you know, Moe Dee might have put some cracks in the armor. But long term, and I don't think it has done anything for either guy other than help them.
Right. I'll say that too with LL. Like you say, it kind of, the battle itself kind of helped him stay relevant and help him cross the bridge into the next era.
Yes.
And then what he did from there is pretty much him, you know, whatever changes he made, that's pretty much him. But at mm-hmm. least that gave him the kick to get over the hump and get into the next era where he's just not a forgotten MC who made some stuff and then you don't right. hear from him anymore, because Lord knows there's plenty of them out here right now.
Yes, there is.
So,
and I think it showed people, too, that there was a level of toughness to LL that they maybe didn't anticipate.
Yeah.
Because I know I've heard stories about, like, how LL would be performing various songs and Modi would be in the crowd trying to goad him into battling him, and he
right.
would ignore him. You know, some people probably thought he was afraid or something at the time.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And he wasn't, because, you know, Jack the Ripper is a hard joint, you know.
Right.
And then you look at later on in his career, he's, you know, had beefs with Cannabis and,
uh-huh, yeah.
You know, on the song To the Break of Dawn, where he goes at LL and Modi.
Yeah.
I mean, excuse me, at Ice-T and Modi
yeah.
on there. So, you know, so he kind of let people know, hey, you know, yeah, I need love, but if you come at me wrong,
right.
I will come back
and
at you.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons we put him on the Mount Rushmore.
That's right.
Very
That's
versatile.
Right, people.
Right.
So once again, I'm going to have to address this. No, just joking.
Yeah.
Because I still got people texting me about, how are you going to put LL on? As if I made the decision by myself.
Hey, man, I was just as responsible for that as you.
Everybody's responsible.
And the funny part about that is a part of me, and I guess it kind of falls in line with how I guess these people out here feel, a part of you don't want to give him that kind of credit, but you have to kind of
right.
just think of it from not only from the artist standpoint, what he's put out, how long he's been in the game, his ability to still rhyme rather well, even when he was, let's say, in battling with Cannabis, you know, he was kind of considered an old man,
right?
You know, but he's still out there throwing some pretty dope lyrics out.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of, yeah. you know, it just kind of goes to show, you know, this dude is kind of deserving of
that. I think what happened, Eric, is that a lot of people confused what we were doing. We were talking about most influential, really, with mm-hmm. Mount Rushmore, and they were going by their favorites.
Yeah, and he had.
And so if LL was not necessarily one of their favorites, they
right.
didn't think he belonged.
Right.
You know, and I can honestly say, and I don't want to get too far off subject, but
yeah.
of the four guys we put on there, the only one I would consider to be one of my favorites would have been Rakim. The other guys, you know, I varying degrees mm-hmm. of like their music, but it was about their influence. So,
definitely.
So as we close out the 80s and we're moving into the 90s, and it's just so we get into an era brought on by the rise of N.W.A.
Yeah.
And gangster rap, which is already more confrontational in your face anyway.
Right.
Even though I just want to say this too as a quick disclaimer, N.W.A. did not invent gangster rap. That would be Ice-T.
Yes.
And that would be 1987 and not 1988 or 89, but they were certainly the biggest force.
Yeah, and on the East Coast side of things, I think Coogee
right.
Rap was
yes.
just as gangster.
He was. He was.
With a lot of his songs, you know.
Yeah.
So.
But G-Rap was in an environment where he was surrounded by other MCs who were, like N.W.A. was on the West Coast and Ice-T was on the West Coast, and there weren't a lot of
right,
prominent rappers at that time
right.
on the West Coast. So because they were so dynamic, they stood out more.
Yes.
G-Rap is on the same record label even as Big Daddy
Kane.
As
Big Daddy Kane and others, right. Yeah, so,
and
yeah.
that makes it harder to stand out. But lyrically, I mean, his stuff is very gangster.
Oh, yeah, it's very gangster. Hell, there's a song he has where he robs a subway with,
right.
like, with his crew. That's pretty damn gangster. And a lot of there's some, you know, salacious stuff being said along with some violent stuff being
no
said.
No doubt.
So, yeah, you know, he kind of was, you know, shout out to him for being one of those gangster rappers at the time. So it's not, like you say, it's not just N.W.A. who kind of started this. There are others before them.
Right.
So.
But the point is, well, what we know as gangster rap, we give credit to Ice-T for starting that.
Mm.
And N.W.A., I just wanted to throw that out there just so people understand that. But N.W.A.'s rise is so great and so dominating that it basically engulfs the whole world. And it's so it's like one guy starts something and hands the baton to someone else, and they run so hard and so fast with it that it's just like an out of control fire at
right.
this point. But the real reason I'm mentioning that is because you start to see rap beefs lyrically and non-lyrical go in a different direction after this point.
Right.
When we get into the 90s.
Yes.
In particular, because we're talking about N.W.A., we can talk about the situation between, to me, their most prominent member, Ice Cube.
Yes.
When he leaves the group and goes solo.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of hostility towards him for doing so. And he has a legit reason. So Ice Cube, for those who don't know, he was the most dynamic member of N.W.A. as a rapper.
I agree.
He also wrote a lot of the material for Eazy-E's solo project, which was multi-platinum too, I believe, at the time. And he said he had made some little measly amount of money. He was driving a Samurai Suzuki and still living at home with his parents.
Right.
And, you know, and he's like, something is not right here.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not getting paid the way I should be. And he left the group.
Right. And some of that can be attributed. Bring on Jerry Heller as one of the key influences.
I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Right. So, yeah, that's kind of one of the spurring things that caused this beef to kind of go where it went.
Right.
Eazy-E and Jerry Heller were, I guess, were more connected together.
Like business partners, I guess you would say?
Yeah, yeah.
Was Jerry his partner or is just his lawyer?
I want to say lawyer and manager at the same time. Somehow he managed to be their manager, too. I could be wrong on that. If any of you people out there know better, hey, hit us up, let us know. So, you know.
Yeah. So he leaves, and N.W.A. releases an EP called 100 Miles and Running.
Yeah.
And Ice Cube.
Good song, by the way.
Yeah.
Really good.
Great song.
In the
good
car.
EP.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah.
So Ice Cube, of course, goes solo. He's got a wonderful solo career. He's one of the top MCs. Does America's Most Wanted.
I was just about to say, please shout out America's
classic
Most
album,
Wanted.
Classic album.
Man.
No mention or references to N.W.A. on that album.
None.
Just kind of let it go.
And the interesting part with that, too, is that he kind of shows his almost disgust with N.W.A., by hooking up with an East Coast crew in Public Enemy and getting down with them. And so, like you say, not necessarily mentioning any particular members of N.W.A. or even shouting them out or, you know, putting them on blast in any way, but he has hooked up now with Public Enemy. And it's like,
and
that's almost
squad.
Right. And that almost seems like, oh, you know, hey, this is just you've definitely crossed the line by doing that. So,
well, you know, Ice Cube says himself that I think he went to New York to meet with one of the guys who had produced Third Bass's album.
Oh, okay.
And the guy didn't show up, and he ends up meeting with Shockley Brothers, you know, from the Bomb Squad produced Public Enemy. And he said that, you know, he had heard that the guys from N.W.A. had laughed at him because he had gone to New York to try to get these guys to produce an album. And so they took it as a challenge to do a great album for him, and they did.
And voila.
Yes. So by the time that's happened, that's a big hit. And then he had an EP called Kill at Will, which is where he makes the first reference to, you know, I have your marks 100 miles and running.
Yeah.
And then D. Barnes, who was a rapper in a group called Body and Soul. She also had a TV show called Pump It Up.
Pump It Up.
She has Ice Cube on her show. He says he make during the promo, he says something about 100 miles and running on there too, making a shot at NWA.
Right, shot at them.
This is when Dr. Dre gets upset with D. Barnes and physically assaults her.
Right,
at a party. So you can see this thing is starting to get sideways.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They made the mistake of saying, there's a couple of things they say about Ice Cube. I can't remember what song it is now, where Ren says, they even call him by his name. I think they actually say O'Shea on there.
I believe so. I think his name came up a few times. Yeah.
Now, on his second album, Death Certificate, he has a song called No Vaseline.
Yeah. I was waiting for that one. Yeah, man.
Now, there are, you know, like we can say there's some discrepancy over, you know, if LL's song was direct enough towards Kumo. There's no discrepancy. There's no misunderstanding involved here. You know, everything that Ice Cube is talking about, when he takes his time, he addresses everybody in the group.
Yep.
And Dre and Easy the most. And he's all, I think the only line I remember about Yella is Yella boys on your team, so you're losing.
Right, yeah. It's like he even throws one at Yella.
Right, but that's all he had to say about Yella.
Right, yeah.
But it is still, to this day, is one of the dopest diss songs.
Ever, yeah.
And, you know, you, to see somebody get lyrically brutalized like that, because that's basically what it was.
Yeah.
And I think the... that's a, another one of those moments where the significance of that to me was that Ice Cube, yeah, we knew he could rap, but he just destroyed a group of people.
Right.
You know, this is like that, that what was so, there's a different level of respect for a dude when he does that as an MC.
Exactly. So, yeah, I like I say, one of my favorite MCs out there, Ice Cube. I know, of course, we kind of see him now as this
movie mogul and everything.
Right, movie mogul, and now he's running the Big Three basketball league, et cetera, et cetera. But there was a time, and I promise you, every one of you who are somewhat in our age range or a little bit younger, you went out and bought America's Most Wanted. You went out and bought Kill It Will.
No doubt about it.
All of those, Death Certificate, you name it. I mean, every time Q put an album out,
no doubt,
you were there to get it. Yeah, yep. And so it that's just a testament to him. I like to kind of bring up the fact of those rappers who we and a lot of younger people who probably see them as now as they're older, they are these people who are running corporations or acting in movies or, you know, whatever. Your Will Smiths, your Ice Cubes, you know, people like that. Hey, these dudes were great MCs back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't sleep on them like that. LL, another one, being another one, we think of him as the dude on
NCIS.
Right. Yeah, but hey, man, props to these people, props to these MCs.
Yeah, and so, these dudes, you know, when you're talking about LL and Ice Cube, you're talking about dudes that actually had to get on the mic and were challenged by somebody and had to respond accordingly and came out on top.
Yeah,
you know, and that's not something like they weren't just dudes who were out there just rapping.
Yeah.
You know, like you can see like Will Smith has transitioned and done a lot of other great things, but Will was not a cat where, you know, he was on the mic having to rip somebody a new one.
Exactly. That is true.
So it's a little different dynamic.
Yeah, definitely a different one. I just wanted to shout him out as one
of
those guys.
No doubt.
Yeah.
You're right. So one of the things, so we talk about a lot of stuff on this podcast that people are familiar with that they may remember. But one of the things we like to do, because, you know, that's how you get most people in, right? So,
right.
But I like to every now and then throw out things that maybe people don't remember or maybe they're not as familiar with.
Right.
So that's what I wanted to kind of address here. So there's one battle in particular. And I was talking to a good friend of mine a while back about this. And I was asking him if he remembered, and he did. So I was talking about my boy Steve Lowry. Shout out to Steve.
Shout him out. Shout him out.
He's a buster, but he's still my partner, though.
Steve, I don't know you well enough to even go with Danny on
but
that.
But that's my boy, and he's big into West Coast hip-hop, a lot of underground West Coast hip-hop.
Mm.
And so in 1994, the Hieroglyphics crew, so Hieroglyphics is Souls of Mischief, Del the Funky Homo Sapien, those dudes, Pep Love.
Yeah.
They battled a dude by the name of Saphir, and Saphir and his crew was Hobo Junction.
Uh-huh.
The significance of this is this battle happened live on the air on a radio show.
Man.
And there is no – so this is – it's different in that there are no you do a song about me and I'm going to do a song about you in 2 weeks, and then you're going to do a song and we'll see who had the best song because – you know, either I had a better beat than you or, you know, or maybe because I had time, I wrote some better lyrics and then I come out on top.
Right.
Because people like the production on my song better. That was not one of these situations. So the story goes, Casual from Hieroglyphics, who's a great MC.
Yeah.
Saphir was coming out, I think, with his debut project and he wanted Casual to be on a song. Casual never showed to the studio, even though Saphir says he was supposed to. He told him he was coming. He never showed up.
Mm-hmm.
He saw his people. He saw Casual's people the next day And they were like, oh, you're making too much of it. And he's like, oh, what do you mean I'm making too much of it? So that's the bad blood. It's because, you know, you're supposed to be here to be on my album. You already have a name, especially on the West Coast, and you're not, and you didn't show up.
Right.
And he said, you know, so now I have this song where I had to go in and write another verse and blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. Casual's point is, yay, I couldn't make it, but, you know, that's not the way studio time works. Like, if somebody doesn't come through, you should always be prepared to make adjustments to your song or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently, Saphir got on the radio on some freestyles, said some stuff about Casual. Casual's people hear about it. And so Sway, who we all know Sway now from Sway in the Morning on XM Radio and from MTV. This is when he was still doing a local show out in California with King Tech, so the Sway and Tech Morning Show. And he actually has he gets both sides to come into this radio station. And I think it's KMEL, I think, is the radio station in California, in Oakland. And they battled each other in the studio, in the at the radio station, live on the air, with no written lines,
right,
straight off the top of the dome.
Right.
Nobody, well, they always accuse Saphir of having written some pre-written stuff. He says he didn't. But if you listen to it, and it is available, you can listen to it on YouTube, folks. If you go and if you pull up Hieroglyphics versus Hobo Junction, you can listen to it.
Right.
And it is significant because of the style of which it was, the way it was done. This is literally like a street battle, like some dudes battling each other on the block.
I was going to say, this sounds like the beginnings of battle rapping to what we know and what we've seen on these, like, these TV shows where two people are on a stage and you have a time limit and you have to spit something from the top of your head that is lyrically sharp to take down your opponent. So this definitely sounds like the beginnings of that.
And
so
it starts off, it's Casual versus Saphir, but it actually, Sway says that they had so many people in the radio station that day from both camps couldn't hardly move. Because keep in mind, now, these dudes are from East Oakland or whatever, or I don't know if it's East Oakland, but I know they're from the Bay. And, like, so their people are coming down to make sure it doesn't
turn ugly.
You know, it's one of these things where your people say, I'm coming to make sure it doesn't turn ugly, but then they turn it ugly.
Ugly by coming, right.
Right. It wouldn't turn ugly if y'all would stay home.
If y'all would have stayed home, yeah.
But a lot of people came in to make sure that it did not, quote, unquote, turn ugly, which it did not, thankfully.
Right.
Everything stayed on the up and up. But it starts off as Casual against Saphir, and then other members of the Hieroglyphics crew get on the mic, and they start rapping.
Mm.
And then I think Saphir may have had a couple of his people that may have gotten it too, but it was mainly Saphir from his side, from the Hobo Junction side. And the crazy part is they did this live, like I said, live on the air, okay? One of the biggest morning shows in L.A. that time, especially in California at that time, especially for hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
And Sway says to this day, he said they took about 500 calls. He said, and I swear to you, if you ask each person, probably it's right down the middle as to who people thought won, you know. But it definitely creates a different dynamic for people. Okay, the battle rap is not just dudes making some songs. These dudes stood face to face,
right?
And they got live on the air,
right?
You talk about taking a risk.
I was gonna say where things have easily gotten personal. I remember a video it's somewhere on YouTube. I don't know, two dudes battling, and there's a room full of people, and this guy is scorching this other kid. He spit his verse. The other dude came back and responded, and he is scorching this dude. And you know how when you're the one being scorched, you have to kind of hold your head down and like kind of listen right, as if you're not affected by it. But the words are coming at him like daggers. And he hauled off and punched that dude so hard.
I know. That's the one, because the dude said, oh, you mad because I'm styling at you.
Yes. That's it. Are you mad because I'm styling on you?
Something like that, wilding on you.
And that dude hauled off and socked him so hard.
Yes.
That is where a situation like that, a radio studio, which ain't much bigger than the room we're in now.
Right.
And you pile in, let's say, you know, 40 dudes.
Oh, they talk about, like, the way not Sway, but his partner, King Tech, he talks about it like it was 100 cats.
Right.
I mean, I don't know, but he said he was literally standing in between them. But the other thing that I thought was really significant about it, too, is not only does it kind of expose Sway and King Tech to the entire nation.
Yes.
Because at the time, maybe only people in California knew about
them. I didn't know
in 94.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember the way I found out about this is that there was an article about it in The Source.
Mm.
So it like. Yeah, I knew who Souls of Mischief was. I knew who Casual was.
Right.
I knew who Saphir was. But I just looked at, I knew who Dell of Funky Homo Sapien. Although Dell was not there, I don't believe.
Okay.
But he's a part of the Hyrule
crew. Right.
But it took them from, these are not just guys that are making records. These dudes are somebody who approaches rap music and hip hop from an artistic standpoint.
Yes, yeah.
They're doing this off the top. They're battling by going off the top of the head.
Right.
You know, and that is a big deal. I think it opened eyes of a lot of people too. I think to the underground hip hop scene in California.
I agree with that. Yeah,
because I think that, you know, at that time too, everybody thought everything from California was just G-Funk.
Right.
You know, you got to sound like Dr. Dre.
Yep.
Or if you're in the Bay Area, you got to sound like Too Short.
Right.
Too Short. Honestly,
E-40, those guys.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sonically, if you listen to the Hyrule Crew or you listen to Saphir. They sonically sound more like East Coast MCs.
I was going to say.
Than they do the traditional or the stereotypical
West Coast rappers. Because, yeah, I'm thinking in my mind of 93 Till Infinity, that song, and
man,
how they are spitting
album,
on that song.
Yes.
Yeah, just on those songs on that album. Real different from that West Coast feel that, you know, we kind of associate with West Coast G-Funk and, you know, that kind of style. So.
No doubt about it. And I think that's you know, it's one of those things, again, where the battle, the confrontation. And by the way, Casual and Saphir made up after they're actually good friends, you know, but they had that little, they had more of a disagreement than a real beef, but it's just significant by the fact that they battled. But but it's another instance in hip hop where the battle or the beef kind of caused some aspect and awareness of the culture to expand to grow and to be acknowledged by people in other parts of the country. Because this thing has always been, I want to say always, but certainly by the 90s when everybody started doing it across the country, it became very regional.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you could get lost in, you know, listening to only guys from a certain region, and that kind of opened it up. So we are going to wrap this segment up. And then in our next segment, Eric.
He said wrap it up.
Yeah. In our next segment, though, we're going to have to really discuss I call it the Shakespearean tragedy of hip hop, which would be Biggie versus Tupac.
Mm-hmm.
That will probably take
that'll take a segment in itself. And there's a few I want to touch on also.
And
we'll touch on some others,
definitely get on those, yes. But in the next segment, that's what we're definitely going to discuss. So if you listen to this entire segment, thank you. That means we weren't completely boring, I guess.
Appreciate it.
And we will catch you on the other side.
Do you want to be famous? Uh-uh. Ask yourself. Do you want to be famous?
Come on. Check out this bizarre rapper style used by me. The B-I-G, I put my key...